Pruitt-Igoe is usually remembered as America's worst public housing failure. 33 towers were designed by Minoru Yamasaki, and they were demolished on live television. That is the familiar story. Declassified records reveal another. During the Cold War, the U.S. Army Chemical Corps used those towers and the black families inside them for a classified dispersion program linked to the nation's nuclear weapons establishment. No consent, no health monitoring. To understand how residents of an American housing project became unwitting test subjects, you have to start with what was built on 57 acres of St. Louis and what was destroyed to build it. Where the DeSoto Carr neighborhood once stood, demolition crews cleared away entire city blocks, row houses, small shops, churches, and the DeSoto Hospital. City condemnation files list 84 residences and 12 commercial buildings razed between 1948 and 1954. The last grid of familiar streets vanished under bulldozers, replaced by a blank expanse of mud and debris. In their place, the blueprints for Pruitt-Igoe called for 33 concrete towers, each 11 stories tall, arranged in rigid lines across 57 acres. Architect Minoru Yamasaki's plans specified ventilation shafts and the skip-stop elevator system, intended to foster community, but isolating floors instead. The new slabs erased the tangled network of alleys and corner stores that had connected neighbors for generations. For thousands of displaced families, the promise of modern housing came at the cost of everything that had made their neighborhood feel like home. Within months of the first families moving in, the promise of Pruitt-Igoe began to unravel. The St. Louis Housing Authority's early budgets show a gap between projected and actual operating costs. Without commercial tenants or a tax base to supplement rent, the complex relied almost entirely on federal subsidies, which covered construction but left little for upkeep. Maintenance logs from the late 1950s record repeated elevator outages, sometimes with entire towers left without service for days at a time. The skip-stop elevator system, designed by Minoru Yamasaki, meant that when a single car failed, whole clusters of apartments became isolated. Tenants reported climbing dark stairwells with groceries and children, sometimes in the middle of the night. Requests for repairs stacked up. By 1960, elevator downtime averaged nearly 20% of operating hours. The absence of commercial rents and the loss of DeSoto Carr's local businesses left the complex with no cushion against these breakdowns. Even in its first decade, Pruitt-Igoe's fragility was plain to those who lived there. In 1969, Congress passed the Brook Amendment, setting a federal cap on public housing rent at 25% of household income. For the St. Louis Housing Authority, this change landed with the force of an audit. Before the amendment, Pruitt-Igoe's operating budget depended on rent revenue from nearly 3,000 units. The new ceiling cut the average tenant payment sharply, and federal housing assistance payments, known as HAP, were recalculated to match the lower rent stream, not the actual costs of running the complex. St. Louis Housing Authority spreadsheets from 1970 show the immediate consequences. Maintenance funding dropped from $1.12 million in 1964 to just $555,000 by 1972, a reduction of more than half. Security contracts shrank, leading to layoffs among guards and janitorial staff. Heating and trash removal contracts were slashed or allowed to lapse. Congressional testimony from 1971 records local officials warning that the rent cap created a monthly shortfall of 73 cents per unit, amounting to $3.5 million each year across Pruitt-Igoe's full roster. The budget columns tell the story, line after line, of red ink, deferred repairs, and canceled service contracts. Without a tax base left from the demolished DeSoto Carr neighborhood, and with no commercial tenants to fill the gap, the complex had no financial cushion. Routine elevator maintenance was deferred, outages multiplied. Broken lights in corridors and stairwells went unrepaired for months. Tenant complaints about heating failures and trash pileups became constant. By 1972, maintenance logs show a 30% drop in completed work orders compared to the previous decade. Security officers, once assigned to every tower, now rotated among several buildings, leaving long stretches of unsupervised time. The Brooke Amendment, intended as a tenant protection, functioned in practice as a slow fiscal collapse. For Pruitt Ego, the numbers in the maintenance ledger became the true antagonist, shrinking each year, erasing the possibility of stability, and leaving the towers exposed to every kind of neglect. As resources disappeared, so did the ability to monitor conditions or respond to new threats, setting the stage for what followed. In the early years of the Cold War, the United States Army Chemical Corps adopted a national directive that prioritized civilian weapons testing in American cities. The logic was straightforward. If a nuclear or biological attack ever reached United States soil, the military needed to predict how contaminants would move through dense urban environments. To do this, the Army required real-world analogs that matched the population density, building types, and street layouts of Soviet cities. The Pruitt Igo housing complex, built on the cleared remains of the DeSoto Carr neighborhood, fit these requirements almost exactly. Planning documents from Operation LAC, which stands for Large Area Coverage, describe a target selection process that valued high-rise concentrations, minimal green space, and a consistent urban grid. The Army's internal memos, some later declassified, list criteria such as high occupancy per acre, structural uniformity, and proximity to major transportation corridors. These same documents reference the Soviet city of Colpino, a suburb of Leningrad, as the archetype. The Manhattan-Rochester Coalition, a partnership between Army research labs and civilian contractors, managed the technical design of these experiments. Their brief was to simulate the dispersal of radiological agents across a cityscape that could plausibly serve as a Cold War battlefield. The Army's rationale for selecting sites like Pruitt Igo rested on the belief that American high-rise buildings could stand in for likely Soviet targets. The DeSoto Carr neighborhood, once a network of row houses and small businesses, had been replaced by 33 towers of nearly identical design. Architect Minoru Yamasaki's layout, with its rigid lines and skip-stop elevators, created predictable airflow patterns, ideal for studying how an airborne contaminant might spread. The Army's site selection algorithm favored these features as well as the demographic reality. By the late 1950s, Pruitt Igo was home to a predominantly Black, low-income population with limited political influence. The Cold War civilian weapons testing program, as outlined in Army slides and technical memos, called for the use of fluorescent powders, specifically zinc-cadmium sulfide, to trace dispersal patterns. The Manhattan-Rochester Coalition coordinated the logistics, while the United States Army Chemical Corps oversaw the on-the-ground operations. The Brooke Amendment, which later capped rent and undercut maintenance budgets, is referenced in correspondence as a complicating factor for site access and long-term monitoring. Lisa Martino Taylor's research would later connect these layers of policy, architecture, and military doctrine, drawing attention to the deliberate selection of Pruitt Igo and similar developments for covert testing. The logic of the Cold War playbook was not accidental. It was calculated, bureaucratic, and rooted in the Army's own framework for simulating nuclear conflict on American streets. Custom CX-5 blower units installed atop several Pruitt Igo towers formed the backbone of the rooftop dispersal system. Each blower, powered by an electric motor running at 1,800 revolutions per minute, was housed in a steel casing with a 12-inch nozzle set near the roof's edge. Designed by the Ralph Parsons Company under contract, these units released clouds of zinc-cadmium sulfide, a fluorescent tracer powder, directly into the wind. The powder, chosen for its visibility under ultraviolet light and ease of detection, was stored in sealed hoppers and fed into the airstream by a screw conveyor. Army Chemical Corps technicians, dressed in protective coveralls, loaded the powder, set the blowers to maximum speed, and logged each dispersal event. Official records show that a standard rooftop cycle lasted between 12 and 18 minutes, enough to generate a visible haze that drifted across the upper floors and balconies. Ground operations relied on modified station wagons equipped with rear-mounted aerosol generators. These vehicles, adapted from agricultural sprayers, patrolled the DeSoto Carr neighborhood and nearby complexes like Cochrane Gardens and Vaughan Homes. The generators produced a fine mist of zinc-cadmium sulfide, with nozzles calibrated for particle sizes between 0.5 and 2 microns. Army teams mapped each route in detail, recording entry and exit times at specific intersections to ensure overlapping plumes. The goal was to funnel the powder into open stairwells, ventilation shafts, and apartment corridors, allowing the tracer to penetrate deep into residential spaces. Aerial sorties added a third dimension. Declassified Air Force manifests list C-119 flying boxcar aircraft and UH-1A helicopters as the main delivery platforms. Flight logs from 1963 and 1965 show sorties at altitudes as low as 450 feet following the Mississippi River for up to 12 nautical miles. Each run was timed for nighttime temperature inversions, which trapped the powder near ground level. Aircraft carried up to 10 kilograms of fluorescent powder per sortie, released through ventral hoppers in controlled bursts. Meteorological logs confirm that operations were scheduled for periods of low wind and high humidity, maximizing the powder's residence time. Residents later described a faint haze drifting across playgrounds and balconies, sometimes glowing under streetlights. Army after-action reports measured ground-level concentrations inside Pruitt-Igo, though much of the data remains redacted. The combined effect of rooftop blowers, ground vehicles, and low-flying aircraft ensured that the tracer powder reached nearly every living space in the test area. Zinc cadmium sulfide, a synthetic fluorescent powder, was the material at the center of the Cold War civilian weapons testing program in St. Louis. Its fine particles, measuring 0.5 to 2 microns in diameter, were engineered to remain airborne for hours. The U.S. Army Chemical Corps, working through the Manhattan-Rochester Coalition, selected this compound because it glowed under ultraviolet light and could be tracked across city blocks and building interiors. The Army's own toxicologic tables, later reviewed by the National Research Council, recorded the powder's ability to penetrate deep into the lungs, a property that made it useful for modeling the spread of radioactive fallout or biological agents in urban environments. Official logbooks obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests provide a ledger of dispersal events. The most thoroughly documented sortie occurred on May 20, 1963. On that night, a C-119 flying boxcar released 10 kilograms of zinc cadmium sulfide over the DeSoto Carr neighborhood and the Pruitt-Igo complex. The flight log records a path along the Mississippi River at an altitude of 450 feet with a total run time of just under 18 minutes. Meteorological records from the same night confirm a temperature inversion, which trapped the powder at ground level and maximized its persistence in the air. The Army's cover story described the operation as an air current study for civil defense, omitting any mention of the powder's chemical composition or potential health risks. The material's behavior after release is detailed in Manhattan-Rochester Coalition technical appendices. Once airborne, the submicron zinc-cadmium sulfide particles drifted with prevailing winds, settling slowly onto rooftops, balconies, and open stairwells. The Army set up sampling stations inside Pruitt-Igo and nearby complexes, collecting residue from windowsills and ventilation grates. Ground-level measurements taken within 2 hours of the May 1963 sortie showed detectable concentrations in corridors, elevator lobbies, and apartment entryways. The Army's own field notes describe a fine fluorescent dust coating surfaces inside the towers. Archival evidence shows that these exposure windows were not isolated. Flight manifests and ground operation logs from 1963 to 1965 list at least four major dispersal events targeting Pruitt-Igo, Cochrane Gardens, Vaughan Homes, and Carr Square Village. Each operation produced a cloud that lingered for hours, moving invisibly through the daily routines of residents. The technical record compiled by archivists and researchers like Lisa Martino Taylor establishes that the exposure was sustained, not momentary. The Army's documentation, combined with later recollections from residents, draws a direct line from the mechanical properties of zinc-cadmium sulfide to the lived experience of those who unknowingly walked through its invisible haze. The connection between material science and human consequence is written into the logbooks, waiting to be read alongside the stories of those who lived beneath the cloud. County hospital logs from the 1970s contain only fragments of the story. Admission records for zip codes covering Pruitt-Igoe and the DeSoto Carr neighborhood show a slow uptick in diagnoses of renal disease and chronic respiratory illness, but the data are incomplete. No registry of former residents was ever created. The St. Louis Department of Health did not receive federal funding to track long-term outcomes after the U.S. Army Chemical Corps concluded its Cold War civilian weapons testing program. The Manhattan-Rochester Coalition, which coordinated the zinc-cadmium sulfide dispersals, left no medical monitoring plan in place. A community health survey, conducted decades later, found that reported kidney disease among those who had lived in Pruitt-Igoe was 4.7% higher than the citywide average. Cancer mortality in the DeSoto Carr cohort stood 12% above comparable neighborhoods. Yet these figures rest on self-reported histories and hospital tables that lack a clear baseline. There is no longitudinal study to show whether the fluorescent powder, zinc cadmium sulfide, released over Pruitt-Igoe by the Army's Chemical Corps, caused these illnesses. The National Research Council's 1997 review noted the absence of controlled epidemiological data and called the evidence suggestive but inconclusive. Former tenants recall a haze drifting through stairwells and playgrounds, but their memories are met with blank spaces in the official record. The Brook Amendment's rent ceiling, intended to protect low-income families, also stripped the St. Louis Housing Authority of the resources needed for systematic health follow-up. Maintenance logs and community survey tables record physical decline, but the medical aftermath remains a void. Lisa Martino Taylor's research has pieced together oral histories and declassified documents, but the gap remains. Residents live with uncertainty, aware of what was done, unsure of what it meant for their health, and left without monitoring or answers. In the absence of a registry, every statistic is provisional, every illness a question mark. The story of Pruitt. Igoe's exposure to Cold War testing is as much about what cannot be proven as what can. In 2012, Lisa Martino Taylor published a study that brought the Cold War civilian weapons testing program at Pruitt-Igoe into new focus. Her research, built on declassified Army Chemical Corps files and oral histories, traced the deliberate use of zinc cadmium sulfide, a fluorescent powder, over the towers and the surrounding DeSoto Carr neighborhood. Martino Taylor's work named the Manhattan-Rochester Coalition as the organizing body behind the tests, documented the absence of informed consent, and raised questions about possible radioactive co-dispersal. The report drew national attention and prompted letters from Missouri Senators Claire McCaskill and Roy Blunt to the Secretary of the Army. Both senators requested a full accounting of what had been released over St. Louis, who authorized it, and whether any health monitoring had ever been conducted for residents. The Army Chemical Corps responded by repeating its long-standing position the zinc-cadmium sulfide releases were within legal limits, the exposures were too low to cause harm, and the operation met the standards of the era. The Army denied the use of radioactive materials and dismissed any suggestion of health risk. No new data were offered. The Senate Armed Services Committee scheduled a closed briefing in 2013, but did not pursue further hearings or legislation. Official correspondence ended with a statement that no additional action was planned. Residents and their advocates sought remedy through the courts. Lawsuits filed in the 1990s and again after the 2012 revelations were dismissed on the grounds of sovereign immunity. Judges ruled that the United States could not be sued for discretionary acts carried out in the name of national defense. No compensation was awarded and no federal health registry for former residents was established. The Brook Amendment, which had already gutted funding for maintenance and follow-up, left local authorities without resources to investigate long-term health outcomes. The site itself remains largely vacant, a fenced expanse where the towers once stood. Martino Taylor's findings stand as the most comprehensive synthesis of the available record. Her work forced a brief moment of political scrutiny, but the underlying facts remain unchanged. The United States Army Chemical Corps, under the Manhattan-Rochester Coalition, used Pruitt-Igoe and the DeSoto Carr neighborhood as a testbed for zinc-cadmium sulfide dispersal. The Cold War civilian weapons testing program left a legacy of unanswered questions. legal and political institutions have acknowledged the episode but declined to provide either full disclosure or redress. The accountability gap persists, even as the physical traces of Minoru Yamasaki's design and the old neighborhood have disappeared. Today, the legacy of the Pruitt-Igoe site and the DeSoto Carr neighborhood remains inseparable from the choices of the U.S. Army Chemical Corps and the Manhattan-Rochester Coalition. No formal study has linked the fluorescent zinc-cadmium sulfide releases to long-term illness. Yet former residents and researchers like Lisa Martino-Taylor continue to press for answers. The absence of accountability endures. Consent and transparency remain unsettled questions. The record waits for scrutiny,